Gentlemen, I just want to say by introduction, we're on Daf Hey Amud Beis, that they asked Rav Baruch Ber. Rav Baruch Ber, his name was Rav Baruch Ber Kamenetz, or he came from a city called Kamenetz, and he was the Rosh Yeshiva of Kamenetz. And he was a great, great scholar, and they asked him what his vision of Olam Haba was. What would the world to come look like? So he said a shtender, you know, we could put his Gemara, a Gemara Yavamis, and a Glezelete, Hesete. Now, why did he choose Yavamis? He has a great deal of chidushim, of insights into Yavamis. I learned Yavamis when I was 17 years old, and I didn't understand a thing. And ever since that experience, I never came back to Masechta Yavamis. I always had like a natural fear of that Masechta. Like, as soon as you say the word Masechta Yavamis, I start getting chills. You know, I get these things going up and down my spinal column. And Rav Myers comes to me yesterday, and he says, "Guess what? I have news for you. Tomorrow you're teaching Masechta Yavamis." It's called Sota officially on top of the page, but it's not Sota, it's the Yavamis part of Sota. So this is what I found out yesterday before I had to give two classes in Masechta Sanhedrin. So I'm going to try to, you know, as I say, I'm already shaking, you know. The Mishnah says the following. Let's say a woman was accused.
What page are you on?
Daf Hey Amud Beis. You weren't here when I announced the page. No. Try if you can to come at the beginning so I don't have to announce the page again and again. If you can. If you can't, I'll announce the page every 5 minutes as soon as somebody new comes in. Now, it's interesting that you gentlemen decided to join me. Most of the other chevra just went their way. I don't know if that's a personal statement. Should I take that?
No, you shouldn't. There were many people in Rabbi Meir's shift.
Well, you know, this I opened the door.
I thought half the class just flew the coop, as we say in French.
We had a small class. Small numbers.
Okay. I guess it's Thursday. You know, people are on their way for Hanukkah. I don't know, Teila. I don't know where they're going.
I had opened the door, and I saw that you were learning. I thought it wasn't time for us to come in.
So. Yeah, well, I was just trying to finish to a Mishnah. You know, sometimes when you have one more line, you get tempted. And anybody have any hot water here by any chance?
I'll get you some.
Yeah, thank you.
Allow me.
Yeah, because I have my need for hot water. So let's take a look on Daf Hey Amud Beis. And I think it's about 11 lines up from the bottom of the page, if I'm not mistaken. And what you're looking for are the words V'yemeis choletzes. Does everybody see that? Let's count up from the bottom of the page. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. How do you like that? 11 lines up from the bottom of the page. Wow. Thank you so much. I was able to guess that it's 11 lines up from the bottom of the page. So last week I gave a shiur in Chumash, not at this hour, but now a little bit later, and I spoke about the number 11. So maybe I can tie that into today's shiur because it's 11 lines up from the bottom of Daf Hey Amud Beis. If you have the classic Talmud Bavli, the print of Vilna,
must be connected.
Now, as usual, the Gemara, when it goes back to a piece of the Mishnah, it quotes that part of the Mishnah. And the Mishnah says, V'yemeis, if he dies, choletzes, v'eino misyabemes. We'll explain. So first of all, let's get the facts on the ground. Reuven is married to Leah. And Reuven warns Leah, as you know, not to go into a private place with so-and-so. That's called what, when he warns her? Kinui.
Okay,
if you don't know the answer to that question, I think we have to review Daf Beis Amud Aleph. I don't know why I'm starting here at Daf Hey. Okay, that's called Kinui. Can you remember that word, Kinui? Again, it's not similar to any word that I could tell you in another language, because maybe we can find some sort of a symbol in the word kinui. Then she violates that kinui. What's that called? Anybody know?
Stira.
Oh, now I'm impressed. So you know that stira, you don't know that kinui. Okay. You got the more important half. That's the stira. Then what happens?
Tuma.
Okay, we'll get to Tuma in just a second. But what happens in the physical universe? What's next in the, you know, in the process here of determining what this woman did when she was in that private place? Anybody know what that's called?
Six.
That's called shtias mei merorin. That means she drinks from this concoction that's made up of some very heavy water, you know, and if she's guilty, you know what's going to happen. But before she got a chance to drink from those waters, what happened to her husband? That's the first word that we're looking at via mace. Anybody? What happened to the husband? Help me out here.
He died.
He died. He dropped dead. Now, I would say that... you know, here's a case where the innocent die. You know, it's what we call tzaddik v'ralo. I mean, had she died, I would have understood. But why did he have to die? I don't know. But in any event, that's what happened. In Yiddish, we say Erez Gishtarben, he died. And we had a Leviah. And we had a Hesped. And we buried the dead. Now, if there are children from this marriage, then there's nothing to talk about. Our mission is addressing the case where there are no children from this marriage. Now, if there are no children from this marriage, I have to ask another question. What's that? Does he have a brother? Is there a surviving brother? Now, it matters not what the age of that brother is, what his intelligence level, you know, what he scored on his IQ exams, and how he did in his, what do they call the O-levels, the A-levels, whatever you call it. And it's irrelevant whether he's married or not. It's irrelevant whether he has children of his own. All that is irrelevant. The very fact that there is a surviving live brother, that generates what's called Zikas Yibum. Okay then? Now I'm going to write that on the board because I know you know it by heart, so I don't want to insult you, but for my purposes it helps me if it's on the board. I actually had a black marker here on the table. So if you get a hold of the guy who stole it, please bring it back to me.
There's a black marker on
it's
the
over
board.
There.
Oh! You see, when you're looking for your glasses, the best place to find them is on your nose, right? So the black marker is here, okay? Zika. Are you familiar with that word? Because the entire Masechet Yevamos, which is a major Masechet in Shas, revolves around this one word, Zika. And Zika means the following. A man was married and he died. He left a widow, childless. Again, she may have children from another marriage, but he was not the father of those children. And he has a live brother. That generates what's called a Zika. Now a Zika means a connection, a bond. Which means that she, the widow, is still bound, so to speak, to her late husband. That's a little bit strange, because the bond between her and her husband is called Ishus. And that Ishus is broken up the very moment that he died, her husband died. How do I prove to you, if I needed to prove to you, that the halacha views that death breaks up Ishus, just like a get will break up Ishus, how would I prove that to you? What would be the similarity between get, if he divorced her, and death, if he widowed her in halacha? What would be the lowest common denominator? That in both cases, she can get married to someone else, correct? How can she get married to someone else? The answer is that get, and in this case misa, death, breaks up the ishus. And if she's no longer bound to her husband because the ishus is gone, he's never dead and buried, then she can marry anyone else. But the exception to that rule is called zika. Zika means she's still bound to her husband, even though he's gone. And that bond to her husband now expresses itself in a mitzvah that's called, everybody, Yibum. And Yibum means that now that bond between her as a widow and her late husband now emerges and reflects itself in a bond between her and her brother-in-law. And again, there may be more than one brother-in-law. And then she has a zika to all the brothers. Let's say this man who died, who was her husband and widowed her, now has five brothers. She now has a zika to five different brothers because each one has a bond, because the issues, the marriage relationship, still exists even after death. So here's the fundamental difference between the two ways that you can end issues, get and misa sabah, which are both codified in the very first mission in Masechta Kiddushin. In the case of get, the issues is gone. Forget it. There's no issues left. It's completely eradicated. Not so in the case of misa. As strange as this sounds to our ears, misa, the death of a husband, does not necessarily terminate and undermine and neutralize issues. There may still be issues after his death. That's mind-boggling. And that's called zika. Again, it only applies if the following two conditions exist. Number one, he dies without any children of his own. And number two, he left a brother surviving. If those two conditions are met, then we know that his misa does not undermine and completely neutralize the issues. The issues still exists. It takes on a different form. And that form is called zika. Now, zika has two parts to it. One part is what we call yibum. Yibum means that one of the brothers, and again, there's a whole chapter in Yevamos to decide which of the brothers, but one of the brothers will step forward and he'll marry this woman and clinch the marriage. But keep in mind, my friends, he is already married to her, even before he does yibum. And that's called zika.
If there's more than one brother, how can he already be married to her?
What I'm saying is that zika is a kind of a marriage relationship which allows for a choice as to which one of the brothers is going to take that zika and he's going to complete it, he's going to expand it through the mitzvah of yibum. So that what we have is, again, I'm going to break it down to numbers, but don't write down any word that comes out of my mouth. Now, you know, I'm a big fan of writing notes. I told you that a few weeks ago, but not in this case. Let's say, on a scale from 0 to 100, issues, in the case of zika, is considered 50. After yibum, it goes from 50 to 100. Now, to the test case, the barometer, is to break up that ishus, which is called zika. In the case of 100% ishus, what could break up that bond called ishus? A get. In the case of zika, which is only 50% of ishus, it's not complete, what could break up that bond? That's called chalitza. Okay? So again, chalitza is to zika what get is to ishus. Just like in the case of full-fledged 100% ishus, the breaking of that ishus is going to be through a get. In the case of zika, breaking up that 50% ishus, as we called it, which is called zika, is through chalitza. However, is chalitza appropriate or meaningful after yibum?
No.
Why? Because after yibum, the ishus goes from what? 50 decibels all the way up to 100 decibels. Once it's 100 decibels, it's full-fledged ishus. The only way to break that up is through a get. So it's very fascinating. What happens is that if, let's say there's only one brother, and he decides he doesn't want to materialize this marriage and complete it through yibum, he wants to take this zika and completely nip it in the bud and undermine it and neutralize it and destroy it. What is his option? Chalitza. Everybody got that? Now, if he decides to fulfill his obligation, and that means to implement yibum, and then the marriage, the ishus goes from 50 to 100, now he no longer has an option of breaking that relationship through chalitza. Now he's going to need what?
A get.
A get. Excellent. Is that crystal clear? Again, this is the only part of Yevamos that I understand. So let's get this part. You know, after this it gets so complicated, but at least I can understand this. Now, both Chalitza and Yibum are a result, are manifestations of what we call Zika. Everybody got that? The Zika means that even after a man dies, under those two conditions, the Isha still somehow comes up from the from 6 feet under. You know, it somehow expresses itself in a bond that now that bond connects her with her brother-in-law, with his surviving brother. Okay. Now the surviving brother has two options. He could either decide, you know what, this is not for me. Maybe because his wife objects to it if he's married. Well, maybe for a million and one other reasons. So he wants to give up on Yibum. What is his option if he gives up on Yibum? And he wants to terminate the Zika and completely uproot it and destroy it? Chalitza, everybody have that. If on the other hand, he wants to complete this issues, then his option is called Yibum. Now let me ask you a question. The man is sitting here in front of me. He just buried his brother. And his former sister-in-law, right, because as long as his brother was alive, she was his sister-in-law, now has what's called Zika. Can she marry anyone at this point? No. If he wants to free her of that bond and allow her to marry anyone, what does he give her?
Chalitza.
He comes to you, and you're the rabbi, and he says to you, Rabbi, what should I do? I have two options. I have one option, Chalitza, and another option is called Yibum. What do you tell him?
Your choice?
No. You tell him Yibum. The mitzvah of Yibum is greater than the mitzvah of Chalitza. Chalitza is a you know, like it's a way of sort of getting out of it. You know what I'm saying? You know, it's a it's what word can I use? It's a cop out. Yes. Chalitza is a cop out. Again, don't ask me from today. Today is totally different. The Gemara says already at the time of Abaye that they instituted an enactment that we don't want Yibum because Yibum requires certain kinds of kavanos and intentions. But again, I'm going back to the original biblical ideal situation in the context of the Bible. Yibum is the mitzvah of the day. We'll give him a cop out. And the cop-out here is Chalitza. But again, the primary mitzvah and the first choice for his obligation would be what? Would be Yibum. So far, so good?
Does Yibum consist of a regular...
Hey, Alan, you want to say something before, I think. Yeah, no, maybe?
I want to ask a question before.
Okay, but ask it in Australian, I'll see if I can understand it. Because I understand Australian a lot better than I understand South African. South African is like very hard for me.
Try to speak like Rabbi Myers.
Okay. I don't know if that makes it worse or better. I don't know. You know, if you're talking about fundraising, then we're all in a good mood from what I hear through the grapevine. It was a great success. I'm not a fundraiser, but go ahead. Yeah.
From when they brought out the Takana that you couldn't be married to two women,
right, that's Rabbeinu Gershon. Ooh, that's much later in history. Go ahead.
Why isn't there anything in here that's changed this that says, Adkan, you can't do Yibum anymore?
Chalitza. Again,
Chalitza, yeah.
That rejection of the possibility of Yibum predates Rabbeinu Gershon by centuries upon centuries, even millennia. It goes back to the time of Abaye. Abai already said that we discourage Yibum. Yeah. We're no longer on the level to fulfill the mitzvah of Yibum. And that requires, Yibum requires tremendous intentions, and the way you have an intimate relationship with this woman is a whole different category.
But you said Yibum is a higher mitzvah than Chalitza.
Right, but that changed with Abai. Abai changed that completely. So forget about two wives. I mean, in Abai's time, you can marry as many wives as you like. But not Yibum. Yibum was out. You know, we wouldn't accept Yibum. So, for example, there's no difference between Ashkenazim and Sfaradim as far as Yibum is concerned. Today, already back in the time of Abaye, you know, before this distinction between, you know, Rabbeinu Gershon about how many wives you have. And I don't know if you know anyone who has two wives. There's a fellow in my neighborhood, he's an old Yemenite, who still has two wives, you know, and is a Rosh Yeshiva in Lakewood today who has two wives. Okay, so I'm telling you that such a thing does exist.
Are they still smiling?
What did he say?
Are they still smiling?
Well, his first wife has to pick up the get, but this is already 35 years, she decides she will not pick up the get. But anyway, that's a complicated business. If you want to know the history of Lakewood Yeshiva, you'll study this interesting parsha, which is called Heter Meir Rabbanim, but it's not for us now. Now, let's open up a chumash if we can. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. Can somebody get me a chumash? Five books of Moses, but all five books. Okay. You know, don't give me one book. Give me all five.
A very strange ceremony with the spitting. The shoe.
Yeah.
What about Yibum? Does Yibum consist of a regular Nisuyan? A regular marriage?
No. Yibum is only Bia.
Only
Bia. Bia means intercourse. And it's not even Bia, it's Tchilas Bia. Okay. It could be that for Yibum, all you need is the beginning of Bia. You know, the halacha gets into great detail about Bia. You know, Bia, there's Tchilas Bia, there's Sof Bia, there's Hazra, there's many, many parts to Bia. You know, the halacha has no embarrassment here about these very sensitive issues. Anyway, that's called Yibum. Now, Yibum is a little bit different than marriage in the sense that it's much easier to accomplish Yibum and complete the process of Yibum than it is in the case of marriage. For example, it could be that we might be able to force a person to do Yibum, again, in the ideal situation before Abaye. It could be that she doesn't have to agree in the case of Yibum. It could be that if he fell off a roof, the Gemara actually has a case, and he fell onto this woman, his Yibama, and in such a way that they had an intimate relationship, that's enough for Yibum, which would never work in marriage. You know, you could jump off a roof, and maybe that would be a description of marriage. But I don't mean that seriously. But you know, you could fall on a woman, and that's not marriage. But in Yibum, it's a whole different thing. Why is that so, by the way? Why are the standards and requirements of Yibum so much lower
than regular
marriage? And the answer is because you're already 50% there. Mm-hmm. 50% away. That's called what? Everybody? Zika. Get that word. I'm going to come into your bedroom tonight, in the middle of the night. I'm going to wake you up. And you're going to say to me, not Rabbi Berson, what are you doing in my bedroom? You're going to say to me, Zika. Okay then? So now we're going to do a test case. I need a choir. I'm going to count to three. And when I finish the number three, we're going to all say this holy word in unison. One, two, three, Zika. Okay then? And if you don't remember the word Zika, I'm gonna hold it against you. You know, I'm gonna wake you up in the middle of the night, you're gonna tell me Zika, because that's what it's all about. Zika is already a bond that exists between the Yavama, this woman who was widowed,
and brother-in-law.
And the brother-in-law, the Yavam. The Yavam already has a bond, and therefore he's only clinching it to the next level, and therefore the standards of Bia and how he has this intimate relationship that clinches the marriage relationship is much lower than what normally, with all the many, many requirements that apply to marriage. You know, for marriage, you know, the Bia, in order to clinch the marriage, has to have many, many different requirements fulfilled. Yeah, Jeremy.
Yeah, good question. Is the woman legally obligated to marry her ex-brother-in-law? Can she say she doesn't want to, or does she have to?
No, because she's got a Zika. Once she has a Zika, she can't marry anybody.
Right.
In fact, if she goes ahead and gets married without chalitza, then there's a machlokas Rav and Shmuel, which is one of the most profound sugyas in Masechta Yevamos, about the child of that marriage, whether that child is a mamzer or not.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, that's serious business.
So she can't use chalitza.
Lozia Eishas Hames Achutza Leish Zar. The Eishas Hames, the widow, cannot marry anyone other than one of her brothers-in-law, if there's more than one, or she gets chalitza. But without chalitza, because again, let's go over it one more time. A get is to Eishas as chalitza is to Zika. And without chalitza, the Zika is like a marriage relationship. Again, it's not 100% marriage. And according to one man, the Omer, if she would, let's say, get married to another man, violating this isa before she got chalitza, the child would not be a mamzer. That's one opinion. I forget who says what. Rav and Shmuel. I don't remember which one says what. But nevertheless, there is a half baked marriage relationship between her and her brothers-in-law or brother-in-law, and that's called what? That halfway measure. Everybody. Zika. Say it again. Zika. Zika is Ishus. It's not a complete Ishus, but it's an Ishus. To break up that Zika, you need Chalitza. And if she doesn't get Chalitza, she gets married to another man, she has violated the Iser of a kind of Ishus-Ish relationship. It's almost like adultery. Why? Because she's married to the Yavam. What do you mean she's married to the Yavam? The answer is that the original relationship of Ishus in her first marriage somehow, as I said before, it rises up from the grave. And it now reflects itself in the bond of Ishus to the Yavam, and that's called, everybody, Zika. Yeah.
So, how much time does the brother-in-law have to make a decision? Because like we get, you know,
yeah, you're right. You know, in the state of Israel today, and I say this b'shvach because I don't know, gentlemen, if you're great Zionists or you're not great Zionists, I can't tell. Everybody has a different opinion about the state of Israel. But one thing I say about the state of Israel, if the Yavam refuses to give Chalitza in this country, they know what to do with it. Now, that could change on March, whatever it is, you know, with the new elections, because if the left gets in, that might be a change mm-hmm. of the history. How old is the state of Israel? 71? 71 years. What I'm telling you now is true for 71 years. I can't tell you it's going to be true in 72nd year, because that depends on the makeup of the coalition government. But if the left gets in, I'm telling you, what I'm about to say might be totally irrelevant. Today, if a man refuses in a Jewish court here in Israel to give chalitza, we know what to do with him. They'll lock him up in a jail.
Okay.
That's not true in Williamsburg. But in Williamsburg, they have other methods. You know, they may get you in the back of a van and they'll do a job on you. I don't want to get into that. I mean, these are violations of federal laws. I mean, you can sit in jail for like, you know, 1,000 years for beating someone up. But in any event, here it's built into Jewish law, because this is the aspect of Jewish law that the Zionist entity recognizes. That could change. And the one who really was the founder of this Hashkafa was Ben-Gurion, who was not a religious Jew. But he understood that we had to create a society that in which religious and non-religious Jews could live in harmony. And therefore the rabbinate was given the power and the authority in areas of marriage. So when you ask me the question, how long can this Yavam dilly-dally until he finally decides to do Chalitza, and this woman never can't get married until she gets Chalitza, and he could wait until he's 150 years old, the answer is here in the state of Israel. We have ways of forcing him to give Chalitza. Have you ever seen Chalitza? How many people in this room have ever witnessed Chalitza? I saw it twice. It is much more emotional than a get. If you've ever seen a get delivered, a get, it usually, after a get, I'm exaggerating now just for drama, but not by much, the first thing they do after the get is they take out a bottle of schnapps.
They tear it up.
No. You're asking what I meant to say. You didn't get my implication because you don't know my style. I was just trying to dramatize that a get is room for celebration. Uh-huh. Because until you finally free this woman of her bond, you know, it could be a very long geschlepte complicated thing.
She's a prisoner.
And she's like a prisoner. Mm-hmm. And basically he wants to give her the get, she wants to get the get, and Shalom al Yisrael. Again, I'm not saying, you know, sometimes one of the two parties is not really excited about the divorce, but generally speaking, in most cases, a get is room for celebration. You know, take out a bottle of schnapps, they finally got the get over with, she's free to marry who she wants, he's free to marry who. Not so in the case of Chalitza. Chalitza is one of the most emotional ceremonies that you'll ever witness to, and I was witness twice, and it's very emotional because basically she has to declare, and in a sense it's an accusation, and it's all written in the parasha in the Torah that this man refused to be miyabe me, And it's all about the fact that the dead brother has no children to carry on his legacy. And it's a very emotional, kind of sad experience.
Rejection.
Okay. So yeah. Is he obligated to take over the ketubah? Was there a marriage without a ketubah?
No, it's a brand new marriage, and a new ketubah will be written. Okay, Marbosa, now I want you to open up to the Chumash. Let's compare two different parshios in the Torah. One is in Vayikra, Perek Yudches. Okay, let's open up. I'm not so used to this Chumash here. Perek Yudches. Okay, this is Parshas Achremos in the book of Leviticus. And take a look at Pasuk Chaf Dalet. Now, if you...
Page number.
Okay, I'm about to announce the page number. If you have an Art Scroll Chumash, you'll find it on page 654. Do you see that? 654. And maybe you could put the ribbon here, because we'll come back to it depending on how much time we have. And the Torah gives a finale. What I mean by a finale is that there's an entire Parashia Achrimos, which, by the way, we read on, anybody know besides the regular Kriya, what holiday, what calendar date we read this Parash on?
Yom Kippur.
On Yom Kippur. Excellent, Jeremy, I'm impressed. And in this long paragraph, the long chapter, the Torah enumerates all the prohibited relationships, and we can summarize them in one word. What is the lowest common denominator that applies to all of the lists that you'll see here in this entire chapter?
Tevel.
Okay, that's called erva. Let me just write this on the black.
Tevel.
Erva. Now, if there's any halachic word that has tremendous legal implications, it's got to be this word. I mean, this is like a prime example of a halachic term that has heavy, heavy repercussions. Erva. Now, what I mean by an erva is that, let's say a man is not allowed to marry a mamzeres, or, for example, a mamzer is not allowed to get married to a bas yisrael. That's not called erva. Mitzri Adomi, Mitzri Rishon, Mitzri Sheni, that's not called Erva. There are many prohibitions, but they're not Erva. Cohen, for example, is not allowed to marry a Grusha, a woman who was married and divorced, but that's not called Erva. That's, again, there are many different shitas. I'm just giving you the final accepted shita, that an Erva is only a very serious violation. And if there's a serious violation, that's called erva. The child of an erva relationship is a mamzer. I mean, that's how serious an erva is. Now the Torah introduces another word to describe all the arayos, which is the plural of the word erva, that would enumerated here in this long, long chapter of 23 verses. And in verse number 24, the Torah calls it altitamu. Altitamu, he says in the English, contamination. Do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now I need you to fast forward, without losing the place, if you can, to the book of Bamidbar, Parshas Noso, and this is going to be the Parsha of Sota. And here, I'm going to tell you in just a minute, Amir Tzashem, what page it's on. It's chapter 5. And it's verse 13, it's on page 754, if you have the Art Scroll edition. And guess what? We're talking about a woman who had kinui and stira, and the Torah adds another word to describe this woman after kinui and stira. Do you see that? It's on the third line from the top on page 754. And what is that word?
Nitma.
Tuma. And here we have what's called Gzeirah Shavah. Gzeirah Shavah means when you have two words that are identical, that appear in two different sections of the Torah, we equate them. You're familiar with that, right? So here, in the Parsha of Sota, after Kinui and Stira, she is called Vinitma'a. And in the Parsha of Erva, which was back at the end of Parshas Achremos on page 654, the Torah uses that same word nitma or tuma to describe an erva relationship. Now, if in Parshas Achremos we have an equation between tuma and erva, then let's apply that same equation to Parshas Noso, meaning to the Parsha of Sota, where again the Torah defines her and describes her as Vinitma, as Tumah, as contamination after Kinui and Stira. Then Tumah equals what? Erva. Does everybody have that? You got to write this down. If you don't write this down, unless you're a genius and you hear something once and you know it, it sinks in. Then, so again, what we see, write down on the top, Parshas Achremos. Okay, that's in Perek. What was it? Perek Yud Ches of Sefer VaYikra. Achremos in Parshas Achremos. We have the following equation: Erva equals Tumah. Now we fast forward to Parshas Noso, in the case of Sota, and we have another equation. The Torah says that a Sota equals Tumah. Now, if we go back to Achrimos, we said that Tumah equals what? Erva. If Tumah equals Erva in Parshas Achrimos, and Sota equals Tumah, therefore Sota equals Erva. And what does this mean, as far as we're concerned? That if a man dies after Kinui and Stira, his wife will not fall for Yibum. Why? Because we have a principle in Yibum that Yibum does not apply to an Erva. Yibum does not apply to an Erva. Let me give you an example. Let's say, just one second. What would be a classic case? I don't want to give a more complicated case. Let me just see if I can come up with a simpler case. Let's say if two men marry, so Ishus Ahuv, and so Achos Ishto. Yeah. Let's say, for example, again, Rabos, I beg you not to quote me on this because you really have to know Masechta Yevamos, and I'm learning other Masechtas now. I'm not learning Yevamos. But let's say two men marry two sisters, correct? Now, in that case, there's a double relationship here. What do I mean? The Torah says you're not allowed to marry
two sisters.
Just one? No. Again, two men are married two sisters, right? That's fine,
yeah.
Right? Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, you're right. But okay, let me just lead up to it. So the Torah says that you cannot marry the wife of your brother. But the exception to that rule, when are you not only allowed to marry the wife of your brother, but you're obligated, if all possible, again in the ideal sense, back before Abai, to marry the wife of your brother. That's called what?
Yibum.
Okay. However, in this particular case, when two brothers marry two sisters, so there's another relationship here. Not only is she your sister-in-law, the wife of your brother, your late brother, but she's also the wife of the sister of your wife. And that's another erva listed in Parshas Achrimos. So now we have an overlap of two different marital prohibitions. We have not only Eishes Achiv, which means that she is the wife of my brother, but that's okay because that's where the mitzvah of Yibum applies, but she's also the sister of my wife. And again, all of Masechta Yevamos is about very complicated marriage relationships where Yibum becomes an impossibility. So therefore, getting back to our Mishnah here in Sota, the Mishnah says, Mes, Eino Misyabemis. She does not fall for Yibum. Why doesn't she fall for Yibum? Because the Torah calls Sota a Venitma, and the word Venitma in a context of forbidden relationships is Erva, and there's no Yibum in a case of Erva. Now you and I know that if a man gives Kinui and Stira to his wife, he's not allowed to live with her. In an ideal situation, she'll drink from the Mei Merarim. But if, let's say, today we don't have the Mei Merarim, then what happens is he has to divorce her. Why? Because he's not allowed to maintain his relationship with her. I think we discussed this in the past. And all this is a result of the fact that with Kinui and Stira, she becomes Tmeah. She becomes contaminated as far as he's concerned. He can no longer marry her or have a relationship with her because she's considered like an Erva, because Tumah equals Erva if you go back to that page that you wrote. Now, once she's considered an Erava, then when he dies, she doesn't fall for Yibum, because there's no Yibum in a case of an Erava. If you followed what I said until now, you deserve a PhD. I mean, this is so complicated. But we're not, as we say in American baseball, we're not around the bases yet. We're really not there yet. Because the Mishnah says, Choletzes v'eino misyabetz, which means that this woman cannot marry another man until she gets chalitza. Now, I don't understand. Is there Zika here or is there no Zika? From the fact that there's no possibility of Yibum, I draw the conclusion that there's no Zika. Correct? And why is there no Zika? Because the Sota is considered an Erva. On the other hand, the Mishnah says that she needs Chalitza and she cannot get married without Chalitza, which means that there's a Zika. So finally, would you please clarify this for me? Is there Zika or is there no Zika? I can't understand it. It's very complicated.
Mm-hmm. I feel much better if you can't understand it. I feel
if there's no...
Again, you know, Yibum and Chalitza are two sides of one coin. That's called Zika. If there's a Zika, then there are two choices here. Either he can decide the Yovim that he doesn't want to marry and he has to give a Chalitza, or he can marry, he decide that he marries again in the ideal situation before Habaye, and he's Miyavim her. All this is a result of Zika. Zika generates a double obligation, or two possibilities, two alternatives. Either he's Miyavim her, and he takes that Zika, makes it into full-fledged issues, or he decides to give a chalitza to break up the Zika. But how is it possible to speak about no Yibum, but yet there's chalitza? What do you mean? If there's no Yibum, you're telling me that since she's a Sota, she had Kinui and Stira, and the Torah calls her in Nitma, and the Parsha in Naso. And Nitma, if I go back to Achrimos, means that she's an Erva. If she's an Erva, then there's no Yibum. But why is there no Yibum in the case of Erva? The answer is because there's no Zika. And if there's no Zika, why does she need Chalitza? That's the Pella of this sugya.
So what's so hard to, in spite of the fact that there is this big question about Chalitza, do it anyhow?
No, it doesn't mean do it anyhow. It
I'm
means
it
that
anyhow,
if she doesn't get Chalitza, she's not allowed to get married. So you're right. In the state of Israel, as I said before, we'll throw him into jail if he doesn't do Chalitza.
So
but do you understand what I'm saying? What happens? I'll give you the following scenario. The Choletz, which means the Yavam, never goes crazy. He's halachically considered a Shota. Or let's say the brother is a what's called a Cheresh, in other words, he's deaf and he's mute.
Yeah.
And I can give you 50 other examples. This woman will never get married for the rest of her life. Which, by the way, I don't feel so bad about that, because she's a Sota. You know what I'm saying? So I don't know how much compassion I have for a Sota. But if, let's say we'll be compassionate for the Sota, because maybe she's guiltless. We don't know whether she actually committed adultery. Nobody could swear on a stack of Bibles that she's guilty as accused. She didn't drink from the Mei Merarim. He drops dead. And if she doesn't get Chalitza, she can't get married for the rest of her life. So she made a mistake, and she had the Stira with this guy. A very bad mistake. Very dangerous business. She shouldn't have been playing with fire. But okay, there was a stira. You know, the milkman came in and there was a stira. So now she can't get married for the rest of her life, because this Yavam can't give a chalitza. He's crazy. He's a cheresh. I'll give you 50. He himself is incarcerated somewhere in a Russian cell, you know, and the Russians don't want to let him out of jail. This woman will never get married, even in the state of Israel, because no one can do chalitza long distance. There's no long distance chalitza. We love Skype, and we love, you know, voice recognition and all that, but you can't. Chalitza means you got to be there in front of a Beis Din and participate in chalitza. So don't think that chalitza is just a nice thing, you know, it's an icing on the cake, and say, what do we lose by chalitza? That's not the attitude that we have to take, because when it says choletzes, it means that without chalitza, as a result of Zika, she's not allowed to marry anyone until she gets chalitza. That's a very serious predicament. And in many scenarios, that would mean she won't be able to get married for the rest of her life. I'll give you another example. And this again, don't publicize this, because it's really scary. You know, in the Kiruv world, they try to tell you, you know, Judaism is just like, you know, eating a bowl of cherries. It's not a bowl of cherries. Listen to the following scenario. A man is married to a woman childless, and he dies, and he leaves one brother who is one day old. He was just born the day before he died. She will not get chalitza for 13 years, my friends. Don't publicize this. Because in the Kiruv world, you'll be in deep trouble, because all of Judaism is about, oh, how wonderful it is to observe the Shabbos, you know, and it helps your digestive system, and so forth and so on. But Judaism is not a bowl of cherries, my friends. Anyone who sells you that, he's doing a Kiruv job, which is good. But he's not giving you the whole picture. In Yiddish we say, Schwerz ist eine Yid. I don't know if you're familiar with that phrase. There are difficulties and challenges in being Judaism, and it's built into the legal system. So when you say chaletzes, you're saying a mouthful over here. She cannot marry until she gets chalitza. But where's the zika? You're telling me that there's no yibum because tuma equals erva, and the Torah describes a sota as tmeya, and yet you're telling me chaletzes. Now, to make the story even more complicated, what happens in the following case? There was Kina and Stira, and then two witnesses came in, or perhaps even one witness is enough, and they testify that she had adultery. What happens now if the husband dies?
No Zika.
There's no Zika at all. She doesn't even need chalitza. So imagine. I'm telling you that the Torah defines a sota because she had kiri and stira. You know, the evidence is, you know, where the smoke, this fire is stacked up against her. And I believe that, you know, she had this adulterous relationship. And therefore the Torah says he cannot have, the husband, if he's alive, cannot resume his relationship with her. He has to give her a get. And then I'm telling you that in a case where she actually had this adultery relationship, then if he dies, she would not need chalitza, there's no zika, whatever. So now, after I just told you that there's no yibum, in the case of sota, means nistera, that was kiri and stira, and he died, she doesn't fall for yibum because the Torah describes her already as a tmeya, and the Torah is already presuming, based on this evidence of kiri and stira, that she had this adulterous relationship, and now I'm telling you that she needs chalitza. But I'm going to tell you that if there are witnesses that testify that she had this adultery relationship, she doesn't need chalitza, because there's no zika whatsoever. Just to give you a whiff of how complicated this sugya becomes. And we didn't even touch the tip of the iceberg here. So Baruch Hashem, Rabbi Weiss has to teach this sugya. You know, I got my own challenges with Sanhedrin, and I'm learning Chulin, I'm learning a little Bav Metzia. I'm about to teach a Gemara in Bav Metzia in about an hour from now. Don't tell anyone. I have no clue what's going on in the Gemara. I've been reading this Gemara in it's about a case where there's a behemoth, an animal that's ownerless, and one person jumps on top of the saddle of the animal, and he says, I own the animal, now I acquired ownership. Another person is standing on the ground, and he beats the animal with a stick until the animal starts running amok. And the question is, who's Kona, and who acquired ownership? Is it Rachuv? Is it Manig? And then the Gemara has the variations. He jumps on the saddle and he holds the animal with his two legs. And then there's another case where he grabs onto the reins. I mean, it's just endless. And I'm supposed to teach that Gemara at 11:45 today. So this was not a great, you know, boon for me. You know, I said, Rabbi Meir Shkoyach, you know, I love to learn with you guys, but like, give me a little bit of an easier break over here. I mean,
Number one, I'm going to quote you to my wife. She keeps on saying, what do you mean you don't understand what's going on? So I can actually say, well, you know, the rabbi doesn't, he admits it as well. Number two, let's get back to the parsha. Tamar.
Right.
First husband dies, marries second husband.
Wait, I lost you. The first husband dies after Kini and Stira. Well, what happened?
Maybe I in the parsha. Well, you heard it.
I thought you meant in the I'm so fatigued in the Pasha of Sota. You meant the Pasha of Shavua. That's my class at 10:45. Oh boy, we got to finish.
First husband dies, she marries brother. He dies,
Right.
She's obligated to marry other brother, but she actually has beer with father. Is she sota? Because she's got an obligation.
So now you're asking a different question. We said that zika is like an ishus relationship. What happens in terms of her relationship to the Yavam, if she has another relationship with another man? We said that there's machlokas Rav and Shmuel where the child of such relationship is a mom. So you're asking a different question. Can she now have a Yibum relationship with one of the brothers? Or do we see this again as a kind of adultery because there was a bond, there was a Zika, and now she broke that bond by having a relationship with someone else? So that's another aspect of Masechta Yevamos. But now let me just get back to our Gemara, because we're going to have to end in about 5 minutes. Let me just sort of give you at least a bit of a direction, maybe a little bit of a light at the end of the tunnel. There's a fundamental difference between the following two cases. Case number one is the sota after kina and stira, and case number two is when two witnesses testify that she had an adulterous relationship. What is the fundamental difference? In the case of a sota that had kini and stira, we do not have absolute evidence that in fact she had this adulterous relationship. When the Torah calls this situation tumah, what the Torah means is that the husband has to treat it as tumah. Objectively, we don't know that this tumah. He has to treat it as if there were tumah, and that means he's not allowed to resume his relationship with her. She's like an erva to him, and he has the only option he would have is to give her a bill of divorce. But in the case where two witnesses testify that she had this adulterous relationship, that is tumah. Not tumah in the subjective sense, vis-a-vis the husband. That's real tumah. That's, we have objective evidence to establish tumah. And then we go back to our drawing board, in which we have the equation between tumah and erva. In the case of tumah and erva, there's no zikas yibum at all, hence she doesn't need chalitza. So now, I'm not telling you that you should marry this woman. I mean, this is a woman who was married to her first husband and she had an adulterous relationship with him, you know, with another man in the context of that marriage. He now divorces her, but I'm not sure if that's the woman you want to marry. I mean, her record is not a great record, but technically, according to the halacha, you can marry this woman. Let's say you assume she did tshuva and so forth and so on, you're allowed to marry. He himself, the former husband, would never be allowed to marry her because she's an erva to him, because we've already established with objective evidence through two witnesses that she had this adulterous relationship. However, in the case of a sota where the husband dies after kini and stira, and we never objectively proved with witnesses that she committed this crime, then we have a kind of a complicated situation in calling her tumah. When the Torah calls her tumah in Parshas Naso, what the Torah is saying is that vis-a-vis her husband, he has to treat her as if there was tumah. And therefore he's not allowed to resume any relation with her, he has to give her a bill of divorce. However, in objective terms, that's not called tumah. In objective terms, we could call it suffek tumah. Are you familiar with this word suffek? What does suffek mean?
Question.
Right, it's a doubt situation. We're uncertain. Now, the halacha in a case of doubt usually says the following. L'chumra. Chumra means we'll take all the stringencies, but we cannot be lenient. So we're going to leave out all the leniencies, and we're going to take all the stringencies. And that's a doraisa halacha. That's a Torah halacha. So we have now this sota. Does she have objective tumah? Maybe yes, maybe no. We right now we don't have the evidence, but it could very well be that she had this adulterous relationship. So now we get to the parsha of Yibum and Chalitza, because her husband died. So what do? We have a suffix. We don't know if objectively in truth she had this relationship, and therefore it really is tumah. So what we're going to say in this situation is choletzes v'eino misyabenes. We can't allow yibum because it could very well be that she has tumah and she did commit this adultery, and that would mean that she's an erva, and in the case of an erva there's no room for yibum. However, since we're in a suffix situation and we don't know for sure that there's objective tumah, we're going to definitely require chalitza. So that the in Hebrew we say pesher adover, the to unlock the secret of this very paradoxical situation in which the Torah on the one hand says no yibum, and then the Torah says there is chalitza, which is a contradiction in and of itself, because either the zika or there's no zika, you know, you make your decision one way or the other. The answer is we don't know if there's zika. It all depends upon whether or not she's an erva. And whether or not she's an erva depends upon whether it was really tumah. And we don't really know this tumah. Again, he has to treat it as if this tumah. He, the husband, if he was alive, would not allow to resume his relationship. He'd have to give her a divorce. But we don't know that there was, in fact, tumah. And if we don't know that there was, in fact, tumah, then we're going to have to go in two different directions, both lechumrah. On the one hand, we're not going to allow the brother-in-law to marry, right, the surviving brother to marry the sota, because if there's no tumah, and she really didn't commit this adultery, then how could he have a relationship with her? But on the other hand, even though we're being stringent and strict about yibum, we have to be strict and stringent about chalitza. And paradoxically, although there's no possibility of yibum here, but nevertheless we're going to insist on chalitz. So again, that would be how do I say a little bit of a light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, we're very far. You'll take a look at the next line in the Gemara, and the Gemara says v'yemeis choletzes. The Gemara says, "Amai, why is this so? Tisyabe nami yibume. This should be yibum." And the Gemara is now saying that even though we're in a situation where we want to take the stringencies because we're in a suffix, nevertheless, she should be eligible for yibum. And the Gemara is telling us now that in a case of a sota who had kinyan and stira, there is no objective tumah. And if there's no objective tumah, then she's not an erva. And if she's not an erva, then she should require yibum. That's how far the Gemara is going to go. Now, wait a minute. What are the chances that she did have this adulterous relationship, and therefore it's tumah and it's erev, and there is no zikas yibum? I don't know. Call it 50-50. So the Gemara says, no, it's not 50-50. It's 60-40 in favor of the fact that she was innocent, and had she drunk from the Mei Merarim, she would have proved her innocence. Why is it 60-40? And that's called a chazaka. That's called cheskas kashus.
But she doesn't have to drink.
Again, if he were alive, she would have to drink, because there's enough evidence to indicate that it's a 40% statistical possibility that she's guilty.
Why should the drinking stop? Because she's being charged. This is
because the Torah only gives the right to one person on the face of the earth to demand and allow that she drink. That's her husband. If he's gone, there's no possibility of her drinking. The Torah gave that as a right to the husband to bring his wife to Beis Din, says, and testify that there was kiri and stira, whatever edom he needs. That's the machlokas in the first Mishnah. And then she drinks from the Mei Merarim. If the husband is not around, or he decides, he said she doesn't want to drink, he could give her a bill of divorce, but she will not drink. Now he dies. So there's no possibility of her drinking. We're now in a suffix. We don't know. Did she have this adulterous relationship? Did she not? So the Gemara asks the following question. Let's rely on a cheskas kashrus. A person in Judaism is considered innocent until proven guilty. And since we don't have ample proof to establish who is guilty as accused, that she actually had this adulterous relationship, we should consider her innocent. And if she's innocent, then there is no objective tumah. And if there's no objective tumah, she's not an erva. And if she's not an erva, there's zika. And if there's zika, then she requires yibum. That's going to be the Gemara's question.
So if he requested that after Stira, that she has to drink the water,
right,
and he then dies, does she still have to drink?
I see what you're saying. I don't know. For that, you'd have to learn Masechta Sota. But you're learning Masechta Sota, so you'll be able to answer this question before I will, that's for sure. I want to wish everyone a great Shabbos, and thanks for being with me today. And again, I apologize if this was complicated. I try to make it as simple as I can, but it's just not simple. You know, that's the objective reality here.
I think there's a real reality question when it comes to the possibility that there would ever be Adam observing the tumah. I mean, it is so impractical that should ever be, that ever happened.
Well, that really depends on a different question. do they, he and she, let's the adulterer and the adulteress, do they have to be aware of the fact that they're witnesses? So let's assume they don't have to be aware. It's what's called Eidus Lebirur Hadov.
Okay, that's
in other cases like marriage, they have to be, he and she have to be aware of the fact that they're witnesses. Maybe even appoint them as witnesses. But in this case of Sota, we don't need the Boel and the Nevelis to be aware of the fact that they're Eidus. So imagine there's a little bit of a peephole. You know, somebody drilled a hole over there, and there are two witnesses who are looking through that peephole. And the Boel and the Nevelis are totally unaware of what's going on. So that is a
fact. Yeah, we had a whole Gemara that talked about, you know, the proximity of the organs.
Jeremy,
you
could you do me a favor and tap Yitz on the back that I wanted to just say hello to him before.
The proximity of the sexual organs. You
right.
Know, you can never see that. I mean, it's so...
No, the Gemara's maskon is, you know, they don't have to see Kim Kol B'Shvokars. They don't have to see the actual penetration. All they have to see is that lying one on top of the other.
And that's enough.
Yes.